Welcome to Season 7, Episode 4 of the Five Trainers Podcast, published on March 26, 2024. We are part of the ConcealCarry.com network of podcasts. I also want to encourage you to check out the Guardian Conference on September 20th to 22nd in Oklahoma City. Register now and save with the early bird discount. In this episode, we'll be talking with Bill Sack from the Second Amendment Foundation about their 50th anniversary and what they do in the 2A community. Help us reach more instructors out there by giving us a 5-star rating in your favorite podcast app, and also share this episode with other instructors. Other instructors haven't been as successful as you have in finding our podcast, so help them out and share it with other instructors. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at the FTA, the Firearm Trainers Association. Visit their website at ftaprotect.com to learn more about their instructor coverage they offer and the competitive pricing. All certified instructors qualify for FTA coverage. And remember, listeners to this podcast can save 10% on your policy by entering promo code FTP10 at checkout. This episode is brought to you by the ConcealedCarry.com business directory. Did you know that you can get a free listing for your instruction business on ConcealedCarry.com? Visit biz.concealedcarry.com and add your business for free. It will be searchable online and to potential students who use the ConcealedCarry.com mobile app. Claim your listing today. We bring this podcast to support the industry, the Second Amendment, and most importantly, every firearm instructor in America dedicates time and energy into making gun owners more knowledgeable. Today, we're joined by Bill Sack from the Second Amendment Foundation. Bill, thank you for coming on today for the podcast and sharing your background with our audience.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm sure many of the people here probably don't know who Bill Sack is. Can you give us a little bit about what you do at the Second Amendment Foundation, maybe a little bit about your background also?
Sure. So I'm a director of legal operations over here at SAF. I joined the team last year over the summer and became director of legal operations at the beginning of January of this year. And as director of legal operations, what I do is essentially manage our legal portfolio. I'm kind of the head guy in charge of the legal department, and I act as kind of the liaison between the legal team and the other major teams here at SAF, the development team, the communications team, making sure all of the information about all the cases we're involved in is getting out to the constituency.
Okay. Well, that's great. Well, can you tell us a little bit about what SAF does over the last 50 years? Because this episode, we're talking about SAF being around for 50 years and educating people, our instructors out there, about what Second Amendment Foundation does.
Yeah, so we are a Second Amendment nonprofit group. We're a 501c3. And what we do is our core focus is the restoration, expansion, and protection of the Second Amendment as it applies to the people. And so our primary two functions that we focus on are education and litigation. So we have a very active legal team. We work in the federal and in the state courts all over the country. We've been involved in over 200 cases since our inception 50 years ago. And currently, the legal department is bigger than it's ever been. And we've got, I think we're up to 58 concurrent active pieces of litigation as of today.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And the one thing that differs SAF from other groups is you don't do much on the political side, do you? It's all in the courts. Am I correct?
Right. So the nature of our nonprofit status, we don't do any lobbying type work or political work. We are a nonpartisan organization. We work exclusively in the education and in the litigation fields.
Well, that's really good, because for anybody who hasn't been underneath a rock, there's a lot of 2A kind of cases that are out there that are being litigated. And I know that SAF is the lead counsel on many of those court cases. So it's been doing quite a bit in the last 50 years, having 200 cases. And I know you probably have done more in the last 10 years than what you've done in the first 40 years, type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, ever since the Bruin decision came out about a year and a half ago now, that's really opened the floodgates once again and kind of refreshed and renewed the 2A space. In a lot of ways, a lot of cases that had been litigated and in many instances unsuccessfully over the last 15 years or so are now fair game again. So ever since June of 22, when Bruin came out, it's been game on, which mm-hmm. has definitely been exciting. And it's, you know, it's fitting that this is happening right around our 50th anniversary. You know, one of the other major floodgates in the 2A space that we saw in the Second Amendment space was also a SAF case, which is the McDonald case. So McDonald versus City of Chicago is another famous case, which is, we're coming up on the 15-year anniversary of that one, or I guess just had it. And that opened the floodgates to be able to sue state and local municipalities for violation of Second Amendment rights, not just the federal government. So it's definitely an exciting time. And yeah, we're super busy.
Let me ask you this, because many people may not realize this, but how long does it take a case to go from, I guess, going from the thought of, you know, we should file a suit along these lines to actually filing it to getting a decision for it, and then even the appeals process from that standpoint? Because like the McDonald case, that was not decided in a year. That was, you know, a decades long type of case. And can you give us a little bit of insight along those lines?
Sure. So, you know, the inception of a case, from identifying an issue to actually bringing the case, can vary greatly. Sometimes that can take weeks or months of long-term preparation. Sometimes it literally happens over the course of a weekend. We've had multiple instances where new bills, new legislation is being signed, and we literally have the lawsuit ready to go, and we're literally hitting the send button on the electronic filing as soon as the governor signs the bill. You know, so getting the cases going, very frequently we can get going pretty quickly. Now, once they hit the court system, that's an entirely different story. You know, we do everything that we can to try to expedite the cases. But for a case to go full, it's full path from, you know, assuming we're in the district court, from the district court through the circuit courts all the way up to potentially through the Supreme Court. I mean, we're talking, yeah, it can be up to a decade, but years certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and each one of those, I mean, all the way up to the you know, Supreme Court, you know, the Supreme Court can decide we take it or we don't take it. Yeah, and you know, sometimes we've got insight into why they do or why they don't. And other times it's just like, nah, not today. And yeah, back to the drawing board.
A lot of people don't realize that, you know, unlike the lower courts and the Circuit Court of Appeals, where there's a right to appeal, the Supreme Court gets to choose what cases it hears. And every year they get petitions for certiorari that number in the thousands, and they take less than 1%, less than 1% of the cases that are petitioned to them every year. So it's a big deal when you get a case in front of the Supreme Court. And the only landmark cases really that we can point to in Second Amendment world, really there's three of them, and all of those have happened from 2008 till now. So it's certainly a bear to get it in front of the Supreme Court. Although we have two exciting cases that we just filed petitions for cert for with the Supreme Court just within the last month or so. So we're hoping that the current makeup of the court is going to be a little more active and a little more interested in hearing some of these important 2A cases.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to these 2A cases and things like that, as much as, you know, we probably would like to think that lawyers work for free, or, you know, they can just do this in their free time. What does the SAF do as far as being able to afford to file all these lawsuits and such?
Sure. So, you know, fundraising and receiving the generous donations of the constituency is exactly what we do. You know, we turn the donations of our membership and of our donors and, you know, from the people and turn that into lawsuits. That is the primary function here at SAF. That is what we do with your money. And we're proud to be able to do it very effectively and all over the country.
Now, in some of these cases, like we were talking beforehand, you can actually sue the you know, the government, and they can pay the plaintiff legal bills. What percentage of those cases does SAF participate in, because I think it's a pretty low percentage overall. And that's why, you know, donations are your lifeblood.
Well, you know, in the classic kind of federal action that we bring, which is called a 1983 action for a violation of civil rights, if we are victorious, we can petition the court to cover our legal fees, to have the government cover our legal fees. And very frequently, when we're victorious, we do recover fee awards, which is great, because the government has essentially paid us to sue them, which is always fun. What you have to contend with, though, is those awards don't happen until the end of the case. They don't happen in every case, and the total that you're allowed to recover ultimately is decided upon frequently by the judge in the case. The upfront fees is really where the donations from our constituency is critical. You know, for us to bring an important case, we don't know if we're ever going to be able to recover fees, number one. And if we are, it's not going to be until the case essentially is long since concluded and the outcome that we've wanted has probably come and gone, potentially even years in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when the McDonald case was there, Alan Gottlieb went along and posted a copy of the check you got from the city of Chicago. And, you know, that had to feel good. But at the same time, it's it can be a long time. It's not something where you start it in January and it's over by December. It's a, you know, you start when you're in grade school, and maybe by the time you graduate high school, you might be getting the money back. Might be, but that all depends on whether you win or not.
Yeah, we always joke that these cases are like marriages. You know, once you get into it, it's gonna be long and it's gonna get ugly at times. But hopefully, there's a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And that's where a lot of the good work that SAF does is pushing on these long cases, because you need to have some pockets in order to, you know, for a Bruin decision, for a McDonald decision, for a Heller decision, all these decisions that we as instructors, you know, probably seen in the last 10, 15 years, but they might have started 10 years before that. And you think about it, even though you're celebrating 50 years, there's probably been some cases. I mean, literally, you know, like the McDonald case and such, it took a good part of a decade to decide and get up to the Supreme Court with everything.
Yeah. Some of these cases can very easily take a decade or more and bounce around. And, you know, one of the tactics that we see frequently in the court system is, you know, if a court isn't going to get to do what it wants to do, what it can do is stall. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing in some of the courts now that are, you know, arguably not as sympathetic to the Second Amendment as the Constitution demands they be, they're playing all sorts of games in terms of how to sit on these cases and procedurally bog them down and make sure that, you know, if it can't turn out the way they want to, at least they can take up a bunch of time.
Yeah, as I go on and refer to it, if they don't like the Supreme Court's answers on things, they'll bog it down until their hope that the makeup changes and in precisely 4 or 5 years, all of a sudden, you know, the winds will be blowing in a different direction. And unfortunately, they don't read the Constitution as if that's the law of the land. They read as those are recommendations, and that's very frustrating for us Second Amendment people.
It certainly is, although, you know, the makeup of the bench right now is probably the most astute that it's been in recent memory in terms of its understanding of the Second Amendment. And We're really optimistic. You know, we've got the Rahimi case that was heard by the court that we're waiting on opinion on. And we're optimistic that this court makeup is going to be interested in settling some of these long-held Second Amendment disputes that, you know, just need to be settled once and for all so the country can move on and we can all understand exactly what the text and the history and tradition of the Constitution demands.
Do you want to dive into the Rahimi case just a little bit, say what it's about, what the basis of it is? Because it's a very interesting one that a lot of people, you know, just assume. But I remember back in the 90s when the domestic violence provision was, you know, created, how big of a burden it put on a lot of people for it back then.
Yes. So the Rahimi case, kind of from a 30,000 foot view, is about due process. It's about the extent to which the government can take away your rights and the amount of due process that you need to be given before you can be disenfranchised of your rights to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment. So, you know, the facts in Rahimi are tough. You know, this is a gentleman that has gotten himself in a good bit of trouble in various ways. But one of the results of that was a civil restraining order against him that stripped him of his Second Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. And the broader question is, you know, our understanding of the Second Amendment and our understanding of the way civil rights work more broadly is that in this country, you are innocent until proven guilty. And typically the hurdle that we all understood and agreed upon was that you had to be convicted of a felony, not just any felony, but a violent felony, you know, by a jury of your peers, beyond a reasonable doubt, in order for you to lose your rights under the Second Amendment. And what we're seeing in Rahimi is an issue where this gentleman was never convicted of a crime when he lost his rights. And so is the civil due process that he was given sufficient that he should be able to be disenfranchised with that sort of proceeding? That's what's at issue in that case. So, you know, we're interested. We're certainly excited to hear what the Supreme Court thinks. You know, we think that the lawyers did an excellent job, and we think that there's really a strong argument to be made that, you know, again, under the Bruin test, does the history and tradition of gun regulation in this country support that sort of regulation? And we're pretty confident that the answer is no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other case that's really interesting, and I think you're part of it, is the 18 to 21 year olds. Is that a case that SAF is involved in?
Yeah. So there are a couple 18 to 20 cases that are ongoing right now. And, you know, while we're talking about Supreme Court cases, I'll also throw in, you know, the Bianchi case, which is another important case that I'd like to talk about. But yeah, on the 18 to 20 issue, there's really two primary issues that we've really been focusing on for the last couple of years, especially since Bruin. One is what we call our 18 to 20 carry cases, where, you know, Bruin made clear unequivocally that there is a right to carry a firearm outside the home. But what we see in jurisdictions all over the country is you have to get a carry permit to be able to carry in many places, as that's the only way for you to be able to lawfully carry is to get your permit. But then they make the permit eligibility 21 plus, which means that 18 to 20 year olds, lawful adults that have all the rights under the Constitution, are unable to carry. And so we've got challenges in multiple circuits going right now on that issue. And then the other big young adult issue is the fact that 18 to 20 year olds under the Gun Control Act of 1968 can't buy a handgun from an FFL. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a young adult under 21, you can't just go into your local licensed dealer and buy a handgun. And that's another case that we won an injunction on and is currently on appeal. So those are the two big young adult issues that we think are going to be settled in the next year or so.
Yeah, those are very interesting, because in my lifetime, all that has been passed. And when you go along and actually think about it, you know, especially with the Middle East wars that we've had, and you realize that there were 17, 18, 19 year old, adults that were going over and fighting the war, and they can carry around all the machine guns and drive tanks and do all the other kind of stuff. But as soon as they come back on U.S. soil, all of a sudden they're less than a citizen to be able to go along and go and exercise their constitutional rights, which, you know, say what you want, you know, their brains aren't fully developed or anything else like that, but if they're developed enough to send them over to another country, I think they're developed enough to have full constitutional rights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, despite the, you know, the emerging signs about, you know, the maturity of our brains and things like that, the fact remains that our legal system says that the age of majority is 18. You're a legal adult when you're 18. You all of your rights vest. You can enter into contracts. You can get married. You can be tried as an adult should you commit a crime. And all of your civil rights are fully yours, at least by the age of 18. And this kind of arbitrary and unilateral restriction of certain specific rights, because they're the disfavored rights. They're the ones that certain people don't like until some unilateral age in the future, is just not supported by the Constitution. And those sorts of policy choices are just frankly off the table, as a result of the ratification of the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing I find very interesting, 100 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for people that were 16, 17 to 18 to get married. 150 years ago, you can read stories about 14, 15 year olds, getting married and, you know, moving out west and doing things like that, where by today's standards, thinking that a, you know, 16 year old knows what they're getting into, getting married and could, you know, jump on a horse and ride across country to make a living for themselves would be, you know, just terrible. You know, that's what history and traditions were, because back then you could go along and, you know, 16 year old walk into the hardware store and buy the rifle, buy a pistol to be able to go along and, you know, protect themselves as they were on the wagon train and doing different things like that. And those are a lot of things that the courts will have to reconcile, because it's not what we think today. It's what the Constitution was written back in 1791 there.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, Rob. I mean, you know, not only were these 16, 17, 18 year olds able to go to their local hardware store and purchase firearms, but under the militia laws in many of the colonies, they were required to have their own firearms and to practice with them and muster with them for their participation in the militia. It was required by law that they had these firearms.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I, really gives you goosebumps, I think, going to Gettysburg and seeing the Civil War battlefield. And the thing that amazes me so much by that is the history behind it, but then you see the monuments. And it's not the monument to the 101st Airborne or the 7th Army or the Marines. It's to the Virginia Militia. It's to the Ohio Militia. It's to the Pennsylvania 3rd Militia. All these different militias that came down to fight the Civil War. And it's kind of amazing to see that. Think about what it was like for 50,000, you know, people to be in that small patch of ground. And then, you know, today we've gotten to the point to where majority of the people back then wouldn't even qualify to be able to purchase a pistol or buy, you know, rifle ammunition type of thing that we're fighting that war.
Never forget what they've taken from us, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And so really good. Well, Bill, question for you, because this is one of those key things why I bring people on the podcast. What can instructors do to help the SAF?
So great question. And this is actually something that, you know, we work hand in hand with industry partners, not just with manufacturers, but with instructors all over the country, because frequently, you know, where people get their introduction to the Second Amendment issue is when they go out and they buy their first gun or when they take their first shooting lesson. And at that point, that's probably the first time that they've interacted with gun control laws. They've interacted with their Second Amendment rights, and they start to understand, well, okay, how does it actually work? What can I do and can I do in my state, in my locality? How do I have to submit myself to a waiting period or some other, you know, burdensome operation in order to exercise my rights? So I think it's really important to remember as an instructor that, you know, especially with the newbies, you know, the folks that are taking their intro classes and their safety classes and their pistol one, you know, like that's the opportunity to really broaden the tent, is those folks that are really being introduced to their rights for the first time. You know, we all know as gun people, right? Like for every one of us that's buying our 10th gun, we need 10 people to go out and buy their first gun. Like, that's mm-hmm. what we want is, you know, we want more new folks who, you know, are just kind of maybe gun agnostic, who don't really have a political affiliation one way or another, but went out to get a firearm for some reason that's personal to them. And at that point that they're, you know, interacting with the gun space, and to the extent that our instructors are often, you know, some of the first ambassadors of the gun culture, you know, letting people know, like, hey, you decided that you wanted that gun for a reason. You know, think about the fact that somebody out there would like to prevent you from getting that gun for that reason. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, to make you wait, or to make you jump through some additional hoop, or to make you say, mother, may I? You know, think about that in the instances where it's really kind of visceral and real to people. And when they're new and they went out and bought that first gun, it's a great time to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of those things where instructors become versed, make sure, you know, when people go along and say, well, you know, I'm okay with it, you know, but we need those red flag laws. I'm okay with it, but, you know, not assault weapons, you know, all these, you know, political touchstones that they have. Go along, get educated, because in each one of those, the advertised or the talked about benefits to it do not outweigh the cost to us as a society, because even from a red flag perspective, the biggest issue that I've seen as you dig into it is due process. And then guess what? They don't do anything for the mental health of the person. So they'll come in and take the guns, but they don't do anything about taking the knives out of the house or taking the, you know, sleeping pills away from them or taking the car keys so they can't turn the car on the garage, any of these other kind of things for somebody who is in a mental despair. And it makes you really scratch your head that if we're that concerned that we're going to take somebody's constitutional rights, take property from them, that we don't do something else. And the same thing when it comes to, you know, like assault weapons and background checks and magazine capacities. Get educated, because in a lot of those circumstances, guess what? You go along and people talk about how great of a benefit they are, and then there's absolutely zero. We had John Lott on a couple episodes ago, talking about, hey, it doesn't work the way they want it to. They tell you that it's going to reduce, you know, all the mass killings. Well, guess what? They're still out there, and it still doesn't do a single thing when it comes to the gangbangers that are there that are going to steal guns anyway. So waiting periods and magazine capacities, yeah, just throw it on top of all the other charts they're going to get and see what sticks. They're not worried about it because they know they'll be back out on the street eventually and just continue doing the same thing they are doing. And that is victimizing people. And that's where us as firearm instructors, we don't want to have unprepared students. And that's why they come to us to get educated on how to work the firearms, how to work less than lethal, how to go along and, you know, legally prepare themselves in case a prosecutor decides to come after them for a legal self-defense case. They're prepared and realize what that legal system looks like or could feel like.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think, you know, really, really is a powerful moment that I think instructors can have in terms of expanding people's appreciation for the Second Amendment is, you know, encourage their students to talk to one another, like at lunch break. When everyone's jamming mags and, you know, stuffing beef jerky in their face, to just go around the room and talk about, you know, why are you training? Why are you carrying? You know, I think, you know, the political talking points, you know, are well trodden, and we're not going to win anybody over who thinks that, you know, taking the guns away is going to solve mass shootings. You know, we're not. But what we can do is, you know, if we go around a room and we talk to, you know, I'm interested in protecting my daughters, I'm interested in protecting my family, you know, like hearing from, you know, a single mother who's interested in protecting your kids, you know, hearing the actual humanization of what it means to exercise your right to self-defense. That's what we're talking about here is, you know, the human right to defend yourself effectively. That's what's at stake here. It's not about, you know, what type of gun I want to buy and how many bullets are in it. The real why, like the real visceral emotional why, is to take care of ourselves and our loved ones. And that I think is where we broaden the tent, because everybody can agree on those foundational ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, the policy issues, people can come around. You have to show them that there's really like an ethical value, moral reason that we're all here doing what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're, you know, if you got people that are curious, recommend they go out and check out the Second Amendment Foundation. If they want to do something, you know, suggest to them that they join. There's some very low cost options to join. And just like Bill was talking about, you know, they go along, they need money in order to file these lawsuits. And even if they recover money from a lawsuit, guess what? That just goes back into the next lawsuit. And it's a, you know, it's like being on a hamster wheel. It just continue to go round and around and around. And most of the cases they win, some of the cases they don't go in their favor. And that's where they need to have the money to, you know, continue to do research and continue to making the legal arguments on why certain things should be nullified or certain things, law should be, not upheld anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have membership tiers that go as inexpensive as $15. All the way up through our lifetime. You can go to SAF.org and then just click on join, and you can see all the different ways that you can contribute and become a member and a donor. We have a planned giving section where folks can actually plan to give part of their estate to SAF upon their passing, which is a great way of, you know, having your memory and your estate continue the fight. Moving forward, thinking about, you know, your kids and your grandkids and making sure that the rights that we appreciate now are around for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Amen to that. Because if you think about it, if it wasn't for people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, going along and supporting the rights, we wouldn't have any rights today. We would be even further behind than what we feel today. So it's important to make sure that our kids and our grandkids have the same rights, or hopefully maybe more rights, or more, they're able to exercise their rights more freely. In 50 years, say, you know, when SAF is 100 years old, it'd be great to go along and say that we're closing down because there's no more fights left. Everybody, you know, we've gotten everybody in line, but I doubt that's that day's ever going
to
come.
Rob, I'd be thrilled. If we get to the point that we're done, I will be thrilled to open up a taco truck somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Me too. It would be great that we could do that, but we gotta be realistic about it. And that's what we, as firearm instructors, we don't think about the possibilities. We think about what's at stake from, you know, that what we're trying to protect. So that is great.
You bet.
Well, Bill, I appreciate your rundown of Second Amendment Foundation and their 50th anniversary and some of the cases they've been involved with. Our question for people in season 7 of our podcast is, what do you do for your mental health each day?
Oh, so my mental health saviors are my 3 dogs. They're my favorite people. So I make sure that for my mental health every day, I spend some time with each one of them individually and as a group, and just turn off the phone, disregard the email messages, and hang out in the backyard with the dogs for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're an audio podcast, but I can tell you his dogs have been coming in and out of his room as we've been doing this podcast. And they're very cute dogs, very cute dogs. Well, Bill, where can people find more information about what SAF is doing if they want to work to join? Can you give us that link again?
Sure. So we are Second Amendment Foundation on all of the social medias. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter. Our main and newly renovated website for the 50th anniversary is saf.org. And there you can read about all of the cases that we're involved in presently under the active litigation page, as well as see all of the educational content we're putting out, and keep track of all the different ways that you can get in the fight, join, become a SAF member, become a regular donor, and help us punch the government in the mouth.
Yeah, and one thing I forgot to mention, which is something really great for people to think about, you put on the Gun Rights Policy Conference every year, and that is a pro-2A conference where they talk about what's going on in the courts, what's coming up, how they're dealing with it, and it's a great place to network. And this year, do you know where it's going to be at, Bill, by any chance?
Off the top of your head? This year, we're going to be in sunny San Diego.
Okay. So if you're around San Diego or want to go to San Diego, it's a very worthwhile, free event to go to. So that's a very good price if you are watching your budget and want to network and learn more about the Second Amendment, society as a whole.
Yep, absolutely. GRPC is a great event every year. We're on we're coming up on year 30 something of GRPC. And yeah, it's a great place to kind of meet your Second Amendment heroes, hear a lot of great information, do a lot of great networking, and man, is it a great price.
Exactly. Well, Bill, thank you again for your time today and the great information. Keep the great work there the SAF does.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
That's a wrap for this episode, and I hope you've found some very interesting tidbits of information on what the Second Amendment Foundation is doing, and also hope you consider, if you're not already a member, to join and support them in their cause. I also want you to encourage everyone listening to check out the link in the show notes and donate to Walk Talk America again in their video development program. I really like what they're doing, and more states are requiring this kind of mental health presentations during your courses, and quite honestly, that's probably the easiest way of doing it, is connecting up with Walk Talk America. If you're searching for information, feel free to go out to the website, firearmtrainerpodcast.com, and search in the upper right-hand corner for any topic you're looking for. You can also see us on Facebook, too, if you'd like to scroll through all our posts over the last several years, but the website's a little bit more efficient. If you have questions, suggestions, you can reach me at ftp@concealedcarry.com. Don't forget to register for the Guardian Conference and take advantage of their early bird pricing. Visit our sponsors, Specialty Firearm Trainers Association, at ftaprotect.com, and check out their instructor insurance. Remember, all the hard work you did in getting your business established, getting trained, well, your next step should be going along getting FTA coverage to make sure you and your students are covered in case of an unforeseen accident. Remember, use promo code FTP10 for 10% off at checkout. We bring this podcast to support the industry, the Second Amendment, and most importantly, every firearm instructor in America that dedicates time and energy in making gun owners more knowledgeable. Stay safe out there, everyone.
Concealed Carry Inc. and ConcealedCarry.com strives to share helpful information and education about gun-related topics, training tips, and other things that may potentially have legal implications for its listeners. The information contained in this podcast is intended in good faith, but it is important to understand that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand laws that apply to them. Nothing in this podcast should be misconstrued as legal advice or counsel.